You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
So welcome back. We're going to now get started with our presentations by the Cohort 8 Echidna Global Scholars. The research findings and policy recommendations from their studies here will serve as the anchors for the two sessions of concurrent panels that are to follow lunch. Lunchtime, you'll all be able to continue networking, so appreciate you all taking your seats now. So please let me introduce our Cohort 8 scholars. Starting us off, on opportunities for systems levels change through multi-sectoral government action is Sumbal and Eliana. Sumbal Naveed is the education specialist at USAID Pakistan, and she will be speaking on the opportunities for promoting girls' education in the federally administrated tribal areas, which is now the newly merged districts, on the Pakistan-Afghanistan border. Eliana Villamarquez is a sociologist from Peru, and her research helps shed light on how improving data collection systems on ethnic minorities and girls is a fundamental first step to charting out policy opportunities for promoting school completion for marginalized girls. Then we'll have Hawa and Jin, who will turn our attention to the teacher's role in creating systems-wide change for girls. Hawa Nubuye is Deputy Country Director at Educate Uganda. Her presentation will discuss teachers' use of gender-sensitive pedagogy for adolescent girls' empowerment. And Jin Chi is Program Specialist at UNESCO's International Research and Training Center for Rural Education and Associate Professor at Beijing Normal University. She'll take us to the early childhood years and present a case for ensuring early childhood teachers in China are equipped with gender awareness. So without further ado, I'd like to invite our first scholar up to the stage to take us into our presentations. Thank you, Sumbal.
Thank you very much, and hello, everyone. So just like Maida, I also studied sciences. I was a botanist and paving my path to be a genetic engineer. But then I ended up being an advocate on education and being passionate about education because I could see how education has changed me and my family's life, especially with having only four daughters and not having even a boy, because that's important to have in Pakistan as a sustainability factor for the family. So that self-motivation was enough for me to be the voice of girls in Fatah and study the barriers and opportunities around education. So for those who are not familiar with Fatah, federally administered tribal areas in Pakistan remained under Talibanization and isolation for a long time. So that actually limited life. Coupled with very strict cultural norms, which were patriarchal in nature, and they limited particularly the life of women in that time. So women were not even able to access education and health, basic services to them. And all of you are familiar with the name Malala Yousafzai and what happened to her in Sawat. But none of you know the names of hundreds of other girls in Fatah who probably faced the similar situation because their voices were lost in this isolated region. So Fatah is a tribal region on Afghanistan-Pakistan border and is a population of 5 million people. If you just look at the current situation of education, it's not encouraging both for boys and girls. But the situation of girls is really alarming, with less than 50% and less than 10% accessing basic education. And now when you look at the difference in the number of schools available for boys and girls, that also tells another story, that not having schools is an important reason for girls to not to go to schools. But that's not it, because there is no more nuance to this issue, which is grounded in the economic, social, and cultural issues of this region. And the purpose of my research is to identify those factors as barriers which are stopping girls from going to school. So my study was qualitative in nature, it was focused on only two districts of Fatah. And I interviewed 36 participants, including girls from college and schools. And the findings of my study are based on my review of education sector plan in Fatah in the light of data that I collected through my study. So let's have a look at those issues that currently are being addressed by the education sector plan in Fatah. But my research says that these issues need to be approached differently when they come to girls' education. So the first one is incentives. So the government does talk about providing incentives, but the people who I talk to believe that any incentive which is more like food for education would not work. What works in this region is scholarships, because more than 50% population lives under the poverty line, and the education expenses are a decisive factor for girls' education, because girls' education is not considered an investment on girls. They have to get married very soon and leave the family. On the other hand, boys are considered the ultimate bread earners and the supporters of the family and a great investment. And next two points are related to the teachers. Recruitment of teacher is an important challenge that we see in this region, because locally, people feel that the local teachers are more effective, but the government is bound to hire teachers from outside of Fatah because of the education quality issues in this region. But now, because these teachers are coming from outside, so you can imagine in this area of post-war situation, distance, transportation, these issues result in the long absenteeism of these outside teachers, resulting in many girls dropping out of the school. And then when it comes to the training of teachers, my study says that in-service or on-job training is more effective. But currently, the government has to rely on pre-service training, which is 2 to 4 years, because there is no current system of in-service or on-job teachers training. So that too is posing a challenge in terms of providing teachers immediately to meet the current huge needs of teachers for these girls. And the girls in Fatah cannot wait for 4 to 2 years. So the issues that I see currently are missing are transportation facilities. We have just seen that there are very few schools, and few schools means distant schools. And to access them, transportation is a must, which to me will remain an issue until the government is successful in providing the required number of schools at a reachable distance. And an important thing that I would like to share over here is the understanding of the broader purpose of girls' education, which my study finds missing in these communities. Even parents do not understand that girls are not just educated to be good mothers. They can be something else as well. So the good news for me is that not all the parents, but still a few, think that girls can do much more than being a good mother, because they can get engaged in any kind of work and employment, which to me is an opportunity. Because this opportunity of having more employment opportunities can create a pull factor, which can attract more girls to attend schools. And all of the girls that I talked to actually gave their credit to their fathers. Because of their fathers, they were able to complete their education. We cannot generalize it, because not every man in the society is supporting education. But this is a good news that we can start with. So with that good news, I can end my presentation with a few recommendations. It starts with having a data-based, context-based planning, particularly around providing schools, training teachers, and hiring them. Another important area over here that I would like to highlight is having a list of those 21st century skills that are important to inculcate in these girls and help them work for the peace, sustainability, and development of this region. It is not possible without having a strong monitoring and governance system, which is possible with having more women in the decision-making position. And at the end, We cannot make only the education department responsible to take this huge responsibility. Other players need to join them in providing more schools, scholarships, and giving the opportunities for job. Thank you very much. So I would like to invite Eliana for the next presentation.
Good morning. My name is Eliana Villar, and I am a Peruvian sociologist. Let me tell you about a case in which an apparently tiny detail made an entire ethnic group practically invisible. That detail was a decision to gather information on ethnic differences in Peru based on language only. That may work for indigenous population who speak Quechua or any other indigenous language, but for Afro-Peruvians who speak Spanish, that decision made them invisible. This is the map of Peru, where 106 Afro-Peruvian communities live. They make for almost 4% of the population. My fieldwork took place in the rural community of Yapatera, which is part of the Piura region. You can see it in the top, in the northern coast. Those regions in color that you see in the map are where most Afro-Peruvians live along the Pacific coast of Peru. This is a photo I took in Yapatera. You can see my shadow there. That was taken last May. That day was 100 degrees, and there was no running water for several days. In November 2009, the Peruvian state issued a forgiveness statement to the Afro-Peruvians, admitting it had made the population, and I quote, victims of racial discrimination that affect them up to date and limit their social, economic, work, and educational development, close quote. 9 years later, not much has changed. I said Afro-Peruvians make for almost 4% of the population, according to the census last year. It may seem very little, but it means almost 1 million people. Until 3 years ago, we knew very little about Afro-Peruvians. In 2014, the special study on Afro-Peruvian population was commissioned by the Ministry of Culture. And the next year, 2015, the results were released. You may know that in South America, particularly in the Andean region, the indigenous population has been historically acknowledged as the most vulnerable. However, this is not always the case. As you may notice in this figure, 75% of Afro-Peruvian females 15 years and older in rural areas have only primary education or less. Afro-Peruvian women have the lowest rate of education, of secondary education too, in rural areas. Afro-Peruvian girls sit in the intersection between gender disparities and ethnic discrimination. In Peru, access to basic education is not a problem at all. Completion of secondary education is. I give you a concrete example. In the Tacna region, 35% of Afro-Peruvian girls and 65% of Afro-Peruvian boys complete secondary education. That means a gap of 30 percentage points. In my research, I defined three entry points to explain why many Afro-Peruvian girls do not complete secondary education. You may see which my entry points are in the slide. I will give you more details in the family dimension this time. But before that, let me tell you a bit about public education in Peru, which is the only choice for poor families. One may think that what is wrong in public education, One may think that what is wrong in public education affects all ethnicities in general. That seems not to be true. One good indicator of poor quality of education is the repetition rate. Observe the differences between Afro-Peruvians in blue and the total population in yellow. That's are the rates of repetition. The gaps are huge. Let's go back to the family dimension. One of my entry points to explain why Afro-Peruvian girls do not complete secondary education is that Afro-Peruvian children whose parents had no education had 70% lower chance of transitioning to post-secondary education. Second, families headed by women earn 16% less income than those families headed by men. At national level, 29% of families are headed by women, but in the case of Afro-Peruvians, 52% of families are headed by women. Peru has a high tolerance for violence, both gender-based violence and the use of physical punishment against children. Violence against children has an impact not only in the development of socio-emotional skills, but also on education outcomes. 28% of Afro-Peruvian children have received physical punishment, 7% more than children from other ethnicities. As you have noticed, key point of my research is about quality of data to make policy decisions, to inform public policy. So here are my four policy recommendations. I should add something. These are my four recommendations, but I should add something else about how feasible these solutions are. First, the context in Peru could not be better. Peru has a strong commitment with compliance of sustainable development goals and the Agenda 2030 to leave no one behind. That includes goal 4, to ensure inclusive and equitable quality education to promote lifelong learning opportunities, and goal 5, to achieve gender equality and to empower all women and girls. Second, Peru has several public programs on education, such as the High Performance Schools and Scholarship 18, among others. How many Afro-Peruvian girls know about these opportunities and are actually benefiting from these programs? I didn't find any public records on this. And the last one is, Peru is expecting to join the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, to stimulate economic programs and progress and world trade. That is a big dream, but quality of education and gender equality are key conditions to get there. Finally, there is research on gender gaps, and there is also research on ethnic discrimination in Peru, but they mostly remain separate. This research, the one I just presented here, is my attempt to analyze them together. Thank you very much. I want to invite now my colleague and friend Hawa Nabuye to present her research.
Thank you. My research focused on the use of gender-sensitive pedagogy as a way to improve the quality of education for girls in Uganda. Gender-sensitive pedagogy ensures that both boys and girls are given an opportunity to participate and engage in their studies without bias. As a girl growing up in Uganda, I know how empowering and important this can be. Uganda has seen a lot of progress in terms of enrollment for both boys and girls, and yes, we still have a lot of work to do at the secondary level, especially where we see that only 24% of girls complete upper secondary and pass to go on to university or college. It's because of this low performance that the government decided to do something and hence introduced policies like the Gender in Education and the National Strategy for Girls' Education to improve the quality. These policies stimulated frameworks, and among the strategies is the use of gender-sensitive pedagogy. And it has several benefits, which include encouraging girls to participate, but here the teacher gives girls an opportunity to not only engage, but to lead discussions and also to participate in all activities without bias or any emotional abuses in their studies. However, we've also seen that when classes are not gender sensitive, we can have consequences. Increased dropouts. A study has shown that if teachers ignore girls or abuse them, they are more likely to drop out of school very fast. And also, because they don't get to participate in good subjects, they don't get to go to university. Like I said, only 24% go to university. It means that they are already headed to an area of unemployment later in their lives. And because they don't get to participate in activities that enable them to practice, make decisions, this affects how they make decisions later in life. Working with Educate has given me an opportunity to advise on curriculum reforms, but and also policies in education with the Ministry of Education in Uganda. And at this time, we are discussing the new national teacher policy. And as our rule, we have to make sure we use evidence to inform such policies. This forced me to go out into the field to interview and also do questionnaires with teachers and students in the eastern and central parts of Uganda. I wanted to figure out how these policies were being implemented in the school before I can make any recommendations or changes, because I believe change happens in the classroom. And I had interesting findings, but I'll only focus on two today. Today morning, we discussed a lot of the gap between policy and implementation. And this wasn't new in my study, particularly because whereas we had high-level policies, they were not directly linked with the school policies. These were two different things. So school administrators and teachers didn't know what these government policies were, and in some instances, what teachers are held accountable to are not the ones in the government policies. 45% of the teachers in service had never been trained in how to use gender-sensitive methods. Some of them even thought it was discriminative, it was not right to be used. And with such mentality, there's no way we can see gender-sensitive classrooms. In instances where some teachers had been trained, around 55%, they lacked administration support and sometimes even mocked by their fellow teachers who lacked perspective, hence abandoning it. Secondly, there were school-level implementation challenges for the teachers that had gone through the training, were motivated and ready to roll. I'm going to go into details. Because teachers have to cover their curriculum, that's what they're held accountable to, not how they teach. They are forced to run so fast to cover content, at the end not using group activities or discussions that would give the girls and boys the chance to practice these activities. Yeah. Secondly, teachers didn't know how to deal with the students. While they introduced these methods and they're really excited, the students were hesitant. I haven't been, participating. Now you're telling me to speak up. And, they didn't respond according to what the teachers expected. And they didn't know how to deal with this. And most of them stopped using these methods. And also, there were some school-level challenges that happened while they were trying to use these methods in their classrooms. And they didn't know how to deal with them. And they lacked follow-up support in those instances. And eventually, they did not use these methods. However, all is not lost. We have a new national teacher policy we are reviewing, a draft that I happen to be part of in my role at Educate. And I think we should use this policy to clearly have frameworks that are easy to understand, but frameworks that will fit into what administration and school policies hold. And with this, I think it will be best to make sure that the teachers who are going to make the change contribute, but also fully understand what these policies mean. Second, align the school policies to support policy implementation. If the policies in school are aligned with the government policies, perhaps administrators will create an environment that supports the teachers to use gender-sensitive methods, but at the same time, hold them accountable. And last, during my research, I heard how hard it is to do in-service teacher training, and it's easy to do pre-service training. However, there are some organizations on the ground that are already supporting teachers on training. And I feel like instead of NGOs trying to do different things, the government can leverage this opportunity and see how their endeavors can be taken on. And they work together with the NGOs to make sure that we have gender-sensitive classrooms. Even if we do have great policies, great gender-sensitive curriculums, but the teachers are not trained or the teachers are not ready to implement them, we'll never see gender-sensitive classrooms. As we think about the quality of the education system, process is going to be very, very critical and key. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. I'm Jean. My research field is in early childhood. In the past years, I lead program on girls' education and women leadership in China. In Brookings, I have the opportunity to combine the two fields, gender and early childhood. Today, I'm going to share why it's important to look at gender and early childhood, and also the potential pathway to integrate it in gender equality in China. International community focus more on adolescent girls and secondary education, pay less attention to the gender reality in early childhood. Can gender and education issues in primary, secondary, and tertiary level and beyond be tackled without looking at the interventions in early years. We all know girls' education and early childhood is the best investment in education. And it's important to look at the cognitive and affective formation of gender identity. Children at 2.5 years can label sex of people. By 3.5 years, children can understand gender stability. By 6 years old, girls tend to believe boys are smarter. So gender stereotype highly formed in early childhood. Evidence from all over the world about teachers, kindergarten teachers, also show teachers' belief about gender have been translated into teacher-child interactions and related to children's acquiring the type of skills, the personality descriptions, and career aspirations. However, those teachers have not been equipped with the skills to support children's needs to develop their identity. So it is important to look at the gender responsiveness in early childhood teaching and learning to open children's potential and development opportunities. But at the country level, there's lack of policy and practices. My work looks at opportunities in the context of China. In China, China has achieved gender parity and compulsory education, and this achievement is grounded in girls' education development. But gender gap persistent in terms of leadership, labor market, and health, especially the imbalanced sex ratio at birth, make China rank among the lowest in health and survival index in global gender gap index. When I talk with the developmental leaders in China, they all agree gender stereotype and cultural norms are the hardest to tackle when sustain the impacts in the local context. Recent years, China focused on quality education and put more emphasis on early childhood education, especially on teachers. And there's also opportunity to promote gender equality in primary and secondary school. Will early childhood education be the next frontier for gender equality and quality education? Take a look at the progress. The enrollments in the past 10 years increased 20%, till now is 79% enrollment in early childhood. So the demand on qualities is pressing. My study outlined the potential policy pathways in Chinese context at the system level and at the teaching level. In the system level, it needs to align gender responsiveness of early child care and education in policy, and also need to build up the institutional system capacity and increase finance. At the teaching level, it needs to increase early childhood care and education workforce from the numbers, and also look at the quality to improve teacher and teaching quality. My research outlined options, potential options for each aspect, and I welcome you to join me in the afternoon session to have a further discussion. And here I share one point in rural context, and it might be interest of other international context communities that would like to transform gender stereotypes in the local context. In rural context in China, there's a sharp disparities with urban context. There's lack of resources, lack of teachers, and teaching need to improve a lot. So it needs to focus on the preferential policies, accountability systems, need to ensure intersectoral coordination that enhance implementation and planning. And also, most importantly, it's for rural teachers to improvement. They need to have the local approach that help teachers to improve their professional development, need to build up a teacher learning community, a strong teacher network, help teacher to continuously develop and make sure that it has happened in the classroom. That includes the technology-based resources and also teachers own change in their mindsets and improvement in their classroom interactions at pedagogical level. Overall, the policy value is beyond building up teacher workforce itself. It will foster the development of human resources of the whole society and benefit household, community, and contribute to the sustainable and harmonious society. A little step at this point, the impact will go a long way. Now, let me have Dr. Kwok to end this session.
Thank you, Jen. Thank you all to our scholars. I would like to invite everyone now to our networking lunch. We will have CUE staff around to help direct you all to where the lunches are located, including across the hall in Summers. So please note that there's multiple places where lunch is available. And a reminder, we'll be beginning at 1 o'clock sharp with two concurrent sessions of panels, both in here as well as in Saul Zilka next door. And then we'll be coming back here for our final panel at 4 o'clock on education diplomacy. So please enjoy some networking and some yummy food. Thanks.